Judiciary Budget Division will come to order. Today is Tuesday, February 3rd, the year is 2009, and we're in room 125 of State Capitol. We will start out this afternoon with a person that a lot of us don't see very often, but nevertheless, he's here when he's needed. So we'll take the Minnesota Tax Court with the Chief Judge, George Perez. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, sir.
State your name for the record, please.
My name is George Perez, the Chief Judge with the Minnesota Tax Court. And to my left is Lisa Feister. She's our court administrator. Thank you. I don't know how familiar I have testified before, and I know that I've gotten good questions and people are very familiar or familiar with the court. I'll just give you some basic facts and then if there are any questions. We were enacted in 1978. We have since gotten rid of any backlogs that have existed prior to that time. We have three judges and three staff members, and we cover the entire state of Minnesota. We handle all tax matters that come to the attention either of the individual 87 counties or the Department of Revenue through the Commissioner of Revenue's office. We handle primarily two types of cases. Those are Commissioner of Revenue cases. Those are cases where once statutes are enacted or amended, there are lots of companies and individuals out there that will test and find out what those statutes mean, and they come before us. And the Commissioner of Revenue is on the other side defending those cases. We also receive most of our cases come from the 87 counties throughout the state that have to do with property tax appeals. And that's where whether they're individual owners or owners of commercial property, once their property is assessed and they bring a case forward in their local counties, eventually they make their way up to the tax court. And we do travel as a court. Again, under the statute, we are authorized to travel to the respective county when it's a property tax appeal case. When it's a commissioner case, we hear it here in St. Paul. Our budget has remained fairly static throughout the years. Last year, it was $875,000, and that's the same allocation that has been recommended by the governor's office for the next biennium. One other factor to point out is last year we experienced a significant increases in cases. That's primarily due to the economy, which is no surprise. When the economy is in a recession, we get an increase of filings, an increase of cases. Excuse me, whether it's a corporation, mom and pop company, or individuals, there's more challenging of their taxes, there's more challenging of their assessments during bad times, and they always end up in tax court. And we expect a similar increase. We had an increase of about between 500 and 600 cases last year to our 3,000 cases that we handle, and we're expecting another 500 to 600 increase. We won't know that, of course, until after April 30th, the deadline to file property tax appeal cases. Commissioner cases can be filed all year long, so those statistics are continually coming in throughout the year. I guess the final point I'll make is that there are fees that are charged and collected by our office. They get deposited into the general fund. And to file a case in tax court, the fee is $240 for regular division and $150 for small claims. For example, last year we collected $670,890 in fees from our property taxes and another $20,250 from our commissioner cases for a total of $691,140, which comes very close to matching what our budget is of $825,000. And we suspect that with the increase in cases, that we will probably surpass that 691 figure of last year and probably come close to matching or surpassing what our budget is allocated for the biennium. And I think that's all I have at this point.
You outlined where your revenue comes from?
I'm sorry, Senator, I didn't hear the first part of your question. Well, I think we're funded through the executive branch, and it's a general allocation that's made. It doesn't closely correlate with what the funds that we bring in, although that's something that I think has been looked at in the past. The numbers seem to come close to paralleling what we collect versus what our budget is. I think that's that's somewhat coincidental, but perhaps also something that's been kept in mind. But really, our budget really comes, it's divided into three parts. It's rent, supplies, and salary. And the allocation is made based on that. It has happened, especially in the recent past, given the increase in cases, is that the fees charged are generating the kind of income that we're seeing in the last couple of years, last 3 or 4 years.
Members have questions for Senator Beth.
I think, Judge, as I'm looking at the budget proposals, it looks like you're going to be pretty much at the same level for the next biennium, which I suppose is good considering everybody else's cuts. But given the increased workload, is that going to be sufficient for you?
Senator Betzel, Mr. Chair, I don't have a direct answer. It isn't sufficient. It's not sufficient funding, but as you said, it's not a cut like other agencies. And we will have to address that when it comes. We have embarked on a number of cost-cutting and efficient measures, from printing things on double-sided, using the internet more, using the website, which is we've created a number of forms and papers and sheets to file, and in some cases people can download them at their own expense rather than on the court's expense. So we're looking at those kinds of measures. We also, as a court, are the only court in the state of Minnesota that do not have full-time, fully paid law clerks. So we do our own work and our own research. And we are fortunate that we are able to get law interns from the local law schools from time to time. That's another cost-cutting measure that was implemented a few years back.
Where do you get the help of the resources for the website development and other things? I mean, I don't imagine you've got those within your agency. Are you able to get those within the branch, the executive branch then? Or how are you able to do that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Betzel, our website was created a number of years ago through a small agency funding that was provided. And we have been fortunate enough to have people that have expertise, such as Lisa and our newly hired, she's been there a year, our judicial secretary, that keep up the website in terms of maintaining it. And we also have a techie that is used throughout the state who we have limited funds, and we're saying between $1,000 and $2,500 to have them come in and update and change it and do whatever formatting is necessary to keep that aspect of it. That's been a real lifesaver in terms of the amount of paper, the amount of communication. And there's also this movement to e-file, and we're looking closely at that. As soon as I think the state converts to that, I think that that will be an enormous cost savings procedure. We're doing that to a limited extent. When we have attorneys that have that capability, certainly the commissioner does, individual counties do, when we're able to communicate things through email or via the internet, that certainly saves on paper and other expenses.
Mr. Chair, just for instance, the Office of Enterprise Technology, have you been able to get some assistance from them to help, you know, you would, as a small agency and some of your technical needs?
Mr. Chair, Senator Betzel, only with respect to CourtNet, we've been able to get resources from that.
Okay. In general, the focus has been to maintain the close balance with the income that is possible with the state.
That certainly has been the case in recent years. Again, due to the sheer number and the volume of cases that get filed, and I suspect that for 2009 and 2010 that the numbers are going to be a lot higher and that there'll probably be even more revenues generated as a result of the filing fees than is our current budget. And again, that's just due to sheer numbers, and we see those as the economy swings up and down. And the numbers drop when the economy gets better, and the numbers go up when the economy falters.
Thank you. Further questions? Probably not. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and Senators.
Mr. Chairman, Senators, Senate staff members, my name is Gary Hurd, and I'm the Chief Operating Officer for Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services.
And I'm Jeremy Lane, the Executive Director of Mid-Minnesota Legal Assistance, serving Hennepin County and 19 other counties in central Minnesota.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee hearing. May I proceed?
Thank you for the opportunity to comment on the governor's proposed budget for Minnesota's Civil Legal Services program.
Mr. Chair, is there anything in the book on this? Or I don't see anything. The budget.
Under the Supreme Court?
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Gotcha. Okay. Page 23. Gotcha. Okay. Gotcha.
There we are. Now we're ready.
There we go. Gotcha.
This is the
Okay. Again, thank you for the opportunity to comment on the governor's proposed budget for Minnesota's civil legal services system. And thank you also for your past bipartisan support for civil legal services and access to justice. In our presentation today, I'll be providing information about Minnesota's civil legal services statewide impact, our role in providing services essential to the efficient operation of Minnesota's justice system, and the effect that our services have on controlling the cost of government. Mr. Lane will address Minnesota's civil legal services impact on promoting public safety, our value as a tool to help Minnesotans who are facing severe economic hardships, and the specifics of what is needed to sustain these services. Our justice system is complex, and especially in these challenging financial times, it has to move very quickly. In order for people to have effective access to this system, it is essential that they have an attorney to guide them through the system, especially when their cases involve critical issues like protection from homelessness, hunger, sickness, and abuse. Minnesota's Civil Legal Services works to provide that effective access to our justice system for the 1 in 6 Minnesotans who are near or below the poverty level. Minnesota's state funding for civil legal services is distributed by the Supreme Court's Legal Services Advisory Committee, or LSAC. LSAC distributes funds to 36 legal services programs. 7 of those programs are regional programs that provide services to all 87 counties in Minnesota. Those 7 programs are known as the Minnesota Legal Services Coalition. In 2007, those 36 legal services programs provided representation in almost 53,000 civil cases statewide. In addition to direct legal representation, Minnesota's legal services programs presented community legal education workshops to more than 70,000 low-income Minnesotans to help them understand their rights and responsibilities under the law. Legal services programs also help support a website that provides a great deal of information and self-help materials available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and which received over 650,000 visits in the past year. Minnesota's civil legal services programs prioritize the types of cases that are most critical to low-income Minnesotans. Cases that help to prevent domestic violence, provide safe, sanitary, and affordable housing, and cases that help students be successful in school. Our case priorities match the state's priorities of ensuring access to health care, protecting the vulnerable, and removing barriers to self-sufficiency. According to the 2000 census, over 500,000 Minnesotans have income below 125% of the federal poverty guidelines. Approximately 500,000 more Minnesotans have income below 200% of the federal poverty guidelines. This would be income of approximately $44,000 for a family of 4. These numbers were collected well before the latest economic crisis that has been especially affecting low-income workers and persons trying to enter the workforce. Our eligible client community is likely to grow substantially as this current recession continues. Chief Justice Magnuson has been speaking lately about the critical work that is performed by Minnesota's justice system. The chief has pointed out that inadequate funding for any part of the justice system, the courts, the public defenders, or civil legal services, affects the efficiency of the system as a whole. Civil legal services helps low-income Minnesotans navigate the complicated justice system so that the courts can continue to efficiently resolve conflicts. In addition, civil legal services programs help protect the public's confidence in our justice system. While the court survey of public perceptions of the justice system shows a high level of trust in the system, there is one segment of the population that did not provide as favorable a view. low-income people and persons of color have a more critical view of the justice system because they face barriers to accessing that system. Minnesota Legal Services Programs helps provide effective access to the justice system, which increases their confidence in the system and their belief that the justice system, in fact, serves all Minnesotans fairly. As Minnesota's leaders look for new and innovative ways to save the state money during these difficult economic times, Minnesota's legal services programs are already working to reduce the costs of Minnesota's justice system. Legal Services annually screens out at least 3,000 cases by explaining to potential litigants that their case would not succeed in court. In addition, every judge will tell you how difficult and time-consuming it is to deal with pro se litigants. Civil Legal Services removes this burden from the courts by using out-of-court time to explain procedures and results to clients so that they understand what is happening without the need for judges or court personnel to explain. People on both sides of the political aisle have supported Civil Legal Services because of the benefits our services provide to the state. In addition to the work of the staff members of the Civil Legal Services programs, Legal Services programs also recruit, train, and support hundreds of volunteer attorneys every year to serve low-income Minnesotans. These services further leverage the state's investment. Minnesota's Civil Legal Services programs help to establish over $4 million in child support awards every year. This is money that works year after year to help single parents and their children become self-sufficient. The child support either helps keep families off of public assistance programs or helps reimburse part of the public assistance that they receive. Our work also helps prevent homelessness and protects families from unlawful foreclosures and predatory lending scams. Keeping more than 2,650 individuals and families from having to access our already overtaxed shelters saves the state and local communities over $4 million a year. Many of our low-income Minnesotans suffer from some form of mental or physical disability. The process for obtaining Social Security disability income or supplemental security income is very complicated and has many procedural pitfalls. Minnesota Legal Services programs help hundreds of people navigate these systems and obtain the benefits for which they qualify. Clients obtain higher levels of household income so that they can be self-sufficient, and the state is relieved of the burden of providing state-funded benefits. This saves the state approximately $5 million per year, every year. Minnesota gets a very good bang for the bucks we spend on civil legal services. That money helps leverage twice as much money from the federal government and from private sources. Minnesota's civil legal services programs have been innovative leaders in promoting efficiency and transforming service delivery to maximize service to low-income Minnesotans. Legal Services has used call center technologies to provide access to clients from every part of Minnesota without the need for an office in every community. Legal Services has used the Internet to more efficiently distribute community legal education materials to clients and other agencies. We have investigated every possible cost-saving strategy, including managing our health care costs. Legal Services constantly reevaluates its priorities so that as the needs of our clients change, our services change to meet them. Legal Services has shifted some resources and consolidated others in order to maximize our efficiency. For many years, we have collaborated in staff and continuing legal education in order to gain efficiencies of scale.
Legal Services is also a contributor to public safety. We're not part of the criminal justice system, but to some extent it's the people we are not able to help that often find themselves in the criminal justice system. Domestic violence is one concrete example of that. A study was done of 10 years of Department of Justice federal statistics on the incidence of domestic violence in America. And the people doing the analysis, somewhat to their surprise, though not to ours, found out that one of only two statistically significant variables had a positive impact by reducing the probability of a woman being abused, and it was the presence of a legal aid office that the person had access to. This did not surprise us because part of the service we provide in the family law area is not just, perhaps getting a short-term respite from a violent situation, but we enable people to actually change their lives, restructure their lives, get out of abusive relationships, get custody of children, get financial support, find other housing, navigate the public assistance system to help get back to economic self-sufficiency. And those have both short and long-term impacts on the criminal justice system. Obviously, short-term, if we can reduce domestic violence, get somebody out of a violent situation, that in and of itself puts less strain on the criminal justice system. But long-term, there's perhaps an even greater benefit. One of the predictors of a young person using violence as a solution to problems as an adult is having grown up experiencing or witnessing domestic violence in their own home. By breaking that cycle of violence, we enable children to grow up in safe homes without being exposed to that and thereby reduce the probability of their turning to violence as adults as a problem solver. We also have an impact on public safety by stabilizing housing for young people and their families. Housing instability is a risk factor for school failure. Reading scores for children who moved three or more times are half of those of children who are in stable housing. Academic failure leads to acting out, it leads to truancy, and it ultimately leads to life failure and involvement in the criminal justice system. I think you'll find the population of Stillwater has a lot of people in it who bounced from place to place and home to home as children. And we help change that at perhaps the most vulnerable point in their lives when they are children. Civil legal services is a tool for economic recovery. Of course, when the economy is bad, that is the worst time to cut civil legal services because that is when more people are becoming eligible for our services, more people are losing health insurance, more people are needing help with unemployment compensation applications. All of those areas that we can be of assistance. The mortgage foreclosure crisis, of course, has people knocking on our doors. Foreclosure cases doubled in our experience between the beginning and the end of 2008. We have had, and I say we, I'm talking specifically about Gary's program and mine, SMRLS and MMLA, have had a joint housing assistance project funded by a private funder. We just learned last week, I'm sorry to say, that our funder cannot continue a $200,000 a year grant to our programs because they have lost almost 40% of their funding from their foundation resources. And so that $200,000 a year program is not going to be renewed in 2009, limiting our ability to provide services to homeowners and tenants caught in the foreclosure mess. In other areas of housing assistance, we've seen a dramatic increase, for example, in the number of housing assistance cases resolved increased 60% between the last quarter of 2007 and the last quarter of 2008 in SMRLS' program. We are seeing half of the clients with housing cases having to be turned away for lack of program resources. We expect those numbers to go up as the situation continues to get worse. We deal every day with people with credit and household finance crises. The debt clinics that programs run at this point are over capacity. Our program in Judicare in Anoka County at this point has waiting lists for bankruptcy assistance because of the increased demand. As a district judge noted just in November, during an economic downturn, you see increases in evictions, foreclosures, domestic violence, credit problems, and crime. And that's what he sees in his district court work. Four of those five legal aid tries to address. I would add to that list health care access and unemployment compensation, as I mentioned. They may not show up in the district court system, but they are showing up in our offices and the administrative appeal processes. Those are all areas where the demand for our services is going up, while the ability to deliver those services is going down. Our budget request reflects increased need. In 2007, we requested a $2 million a year increase. The legislature was able to provide only $1 million of that, and unfortunately was not able to add that $1 million to the base appropriation for civil legal services, and that base was cut another $124,000 in 2008. What that means is with no base cut in 2009, civil legal services is going to lose $1 million in capacity because of that $1 million appropriation that will sunset at the end of June. We used the increase that we did get to maintain services. It was not possible for us to add staffing at that time. Now, unfortunately, on top of the loss in funding that we face with no base cut, the governor's proposal has recommended cutting the base funding by another 5%, which will cut seriously into our ability to serve clients. The combination of the non-base appropriation that will go away, the base cut that's proposed, a dramatic loss in funding through the Interest on Lawyer Trust Account program, whose revenues have been cut roughly in half in the last year, we are facing the loss of the ability to serve between 3,500 and 4,500 low-income families in the next year. Now, it may seem irrational. We have asked the legislature through the budget process to increase funding $2 million a year. And we know, of course, the budget crisis that you face. And it may seem truly irrational to even talk about increasing funding during the budget crisis. The problem we face is that this is not about us. This is not about Gary Hurd or myself. It's not about our staff. It's not about our programs. It's about the people we serve, your constituents, the most vulnerable of your constituents, the most vulnerable people in the state, the people at the bottom of the economic ladder who are suffering the most during these hard times. These are the people being laid off. These are the people losing health insurance. These are the people experiencing increased domestic violence in their homes. And these are the people showing up on our doorsteps asking for services. And so it is on their behalf that we are hoping that you can find some way to at least enable us to maintain the services that we're trying to deliver. What we do is about maintaining the integrity of the rule of law. It's one of the fundamental promises that a society makes to its citizens, that they can have access to justice and that the rule of law does apply to them. And we are part of the justice system, and as the third branch of government, we and the justice system need to be a priority so that people will be safe and will have access to justice. We are, and we recognize we are, a small part of the justice system, although we are an integral part of that promise of making justice for all a reality. The justice system is only 2% of the state budget. Civil legal services is only 3% of the justice system's piece of the state budget. But we are charged with serving the most vulnerable 1/6 of the population with that very, very small piece of the budget. We would like to acknowledge the leadership that the Chief Justice is showing on behalf of the whole justice system, and we appreciate that as we all try to maintain the ability to deliver services. As you are charged with trying to help the state and its citizens navigate their way through this terrible economic downturn, we hope that you can help us to be part of that. We appreciate the support you have provided over the years. And we appreciate the support provided by the court, by the State Bar Association, and by our other partners in the justice system. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your support, and we would welcome the opportunity to answer any questions now or later.
When you look at your funding, and I realize what the governor has discussed, have you get United Way and some other types of funding?
We do, and it is like the rest of our funding situation, it's mostly bad news. The only good news I can relate, for example, on the United Way Fund is that one of our programs, that's United Way funding, didn't get cut. One of our programs did get cut. We lost a United Way funded program of over $100,000 this past year, not because of any deficiency in the program, but because the United Way is forced by its economics to narrow and narrow and narrow its funding priorities and its ability to deliver services. And in the process of narrowing their priorities, one of the programs that we provide, unfortunately, that serves children, was simply defined out of eligibility for United Way funding. So we lost that $100,000 a year funding source from the United Way. Again, not because of anything we were doing wrong, not because the United Way didn't want to fund the work we were doing, but because the United Way is being forced by the same economic downturn to tighten and tighten its priorities. And as the United Way continues to revise its priorities, we live in fear over the next year that other programs we have that are funded by the United Way will similarly face being cut back. Because the United Way's resources are at best stagnant, and of course the cost of delivering those services continues to go up. So it's a bleak picture. And of course foundations have lost 30-40% of their value, and so we try to be very resourceful about going to foundations, large and small, and we are starting to get the bad news. I mentioned the one housing program that SMRLS and MMLA jointly get funding for that took a major hit. And we expect, as foundation grants are coming up for renewal, that we're going to be getting the same bad news from other foundations which have been supportive of our work over many years.
At one time, the Federal Legal Services provided considerable more support.
Your memory is correct, Mr. Chairman, and that's a fairly stark picture. Congress has tried a couple of times in the past years to recapture some of the lost ground. The purchasing power of the federal funding is down between 50-60% from where it was in your somewhat more remote memory. Efforts to recapture even some of that lost ground got stymied by disagreements between the branches of government. And now, of course, the branches of government may agree on priorities, but they're so much worse off than having no money. They are bleeding worse than the state is. And so we are hoping that, you know, there might be a couple of percentage points increase in the federal funding. At the moment, the federal funding is on maintenance level with no increase, and nobody knows whether the new administration will simply sort of give up on the current fiscal year and focus their efforts on the next fiscal year that's coming up. There may be in some there is in one of the stimulus package proposals some money that would be targeted to helping provide legal services to people in the 100 metropolitan areas nationally that have been the worst hit by the foreclosure mess. And so there might be, if Congress approves it, some money coming into the metro area to help some people with foreclosure problems. But it's narrowly defined, narrowly targeted, and as currently structured, would do nothing outside the metro area. So those of you representing rural constituents, so far, there's nothing in that stimulus package that would do anything in terms of legal service for any of your constituents.
Senator Betts.
So
Thank you. I've got a couple of questions regarding what you were seeking and then what actually is being proposed by the governor. On pages 22 and 23 of the books that we have, this appears to be what you had requested, basically a $2 million per year increase for $4 million for the biennium. And you had indicated this would be part of just restoring the one-time money that was provided in 2007. But apparently, though, that this goes beyond just restoring the one-time money and actually adds more in there. Could you clarify just which is just restoring it and which is going beyond? What do we do if you actually have the full amount that you requested?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Betzold, you're correct. Of that $2 million per year, $1 million would continue the appropriation that was put in place in 2007, but which is scheduled to sunset in June. The second million would be new in terms of legislative funding. Unfortunately, what it would do would be to help replace what is at this point at least $1 million a year in lost IOLTA funding. The Interest on Lawyer Trust Account program was created by the Supreme Court, and it generates revenue from the interest earned on small and short-term trust accounts held by lawyers of their clients' funds. That program, which was receiving revenues of approximately $2.8 million a year, has seen that revenue basically cut in half in the last roughly year. Combination of interest rates themselves going down and the downturn in the economy. So that the grants made through that program are going to go down in the current year at least $500,000 a year. And we have every expectation, because this is not a problem that's going to go away, that over the next couple of years, that in fact the grants are probably going to go down $1 million a year. So that if the legislature were able to not only replace the $1 million appropriation that we face losing, but increase $1 million, at best we think that would go to help us maintain services we are providing now, or at least slow down the rate at which they'd have to go down.
So Mr. Chair, then basically the $4 million is just replacing the one-time money from the base in 07 and the anticipated loss of the interest on lawyers' trust account funds. So it doesn't put you in any great...
It doesn't put us in a better position, Mr. Chairman, Senator Betzold. That's right. And as I say, we are just simply trying not to think about the other losses that nobody has any capacity to replace, like the foundation funding and United Way funding. Right. So the reality is that if our best case scenario before this committee came true, our capacity to serve clients is going to shrink in the next 2 years, just not as catastrophically as if the base funding goes down.
Well, then back on page 14 is the governor's recommendation, and the governor's recommending a cut of $601,000 in 10 and then a similar amount in 11, total of $1,202,000. I assume that's about a 5% cut, but does that mean that, would that be, cutting your current programs in addition to the loss of the one-time money and in addition to the potential loss of the interest on lawyers' trust account?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Betzold, that's right. The effective cut in terms of our appropriation would be 12%, because of the non-renewal of the $1 million that is not in the base. So if that goes away and the $600,000 is taken away from the base, the impact in terms of our appropriation is a 12% cut. Then you have the IOLTA loss on top of that. and the foundation funds loss on top of that. So it really is a cascading loss. There isn't any bright spot. We are asking our friends in the private sector, the large law firms and the small law firms and the solo practitioners, we ask them to help out. The best news we see there is that some of them are having to cut because law firms are losing business like everybody else. Some of the firms are able to maintain their grants to us even in the face of their revenues going down, and we're very grateful for that ability, that commitment on their part to maintain their contributions to us. We take that as a recognition of the importance of what we're doing, but they're not doing well either. And so the best news we have there is that some of them are not cutting. Some of them are.
What is the current status on the housing? Does that show any sign of moving to the muscle?
Mr. Chairman, not in my program's experience. The contrary is true. And we live in terror. I'm not an expert myself. You know, the nature of my job after 40 years, I know a little bit about a lot of things and not much about anything. But there are large numbers of mortgages with adjustable rates that are about to have their rates adjusted dramatically up in 2009. And we have been told to expect a significant increase in foreclosures of a group of clients in 2009 that haven't been hit yet.
If the governor's proposal were to be adopted and you don't get new money from some of these other sources that you're asking for, what does that mean? Is it 12% plus?
The estimate, it means layoffs. I mean, our program, like, you know, the public defenders and others, it's overwhelmingly personnel costs. The legal services folks are already the lowest paid lawyers in the justice system. We've already been cutting back on health insurance benefits. What it means is losing staff, and what that means is clients are simply being turned down. And depending on how many of these losses combine, we look at, you know, somewhere between 3,500 and 5,000 families or more whom we are able to serve now simply going without service next year. We just have to say no. And these people, unfortunately, some of them will wind up homeless in the shelters, which, of course, the taxpayers pay for. Some of them will wind up in front of one of the district judges, pro se, because they don't disappear from the system. They just clog it up. So they'll be trying to navigate, whether it's the eviction court or, you know, domestic abuse court or wherever, without lawyers, just making those courts operate less efficiently, and there's nothing the judges can do about that. So some of them will drop off the radar screen. They'll be homeless, and nobody will hear about them. Some of them will wind up in the justice system. Some of them will wind up in emergency rooms, which, of course, is the most expensive, least efficient way to deliver health care. If we are not able to get them on medical assistance or Medicare, they're going to wind up in emergency rooms for their medical care. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Committee members.
We now are going to item number 3, the Public Defense Board. Mr. Kyer.
Chairman and members, for the record, my name is Kevin Kyer. I'm the Chief Administrator for the Board of Public Defense. Excuse me. With me today is the Chief District Public Defender for the 10th Judicial District, Bill Ward. Mr. Chairman, you all have a handout that we provided, as well as a letter to the legislative leadership from the chair of our board, which goes into some of the detail about the impacts of the proposed governor's budget. I want to talk a little bit this afternoon about the background, kind of where we're at, kind of some of the things that we're seeing, a little bit about the impacts, and turn it over to Mr. Ward of kind of the impacts on the ground, if you will, and then follow up a little bit with our 2010-2011 budget request. As Mr. Lane said, it is kind of seems to be a little irrational to be talking about increased funding in this time, but I think some of it points out some of the issues or the challenges that the board is facing going into the next two-year period. So, Mr. Chairman and members, as all of you know, and because you've been around here, is the board provides mandated services on the trial level and on the appellate level in the district courts. They do that through what we consider to be a very cost-effective method of doing it, including full-time offices, some full-time defenders, and also part-time defenders. About half of our lawyers are part-time, and we'll talk a little bit about that as we get into this. They are paid on a lump sum basis and basically agree to take whatever cases come down the pipe to them. It's very efficient, but it's also a very taxing system on those folks, and it is a system that we're hoping to be able to maintain. Faced with some budget difficulties back in 2003 and again in 2005, the board put together a list of budget principles and service priorities that it would use as it looked at staffing reductions, as it looked at budget reductions. And again, I just want to touch on them briefly because it kind of goes back to the discussion that we had regarding the child protection cases, but also what it means for the future, given the potential for some budget reductions. The top priority is obviously to prioritize service to clients in custody, the evaluation of the specialty courts, and also the elimination of representation in non-mandatory cases, which, again, we talked about the last time we were here. We have roughly 375 full-time equivalent lawyers around the state. Again, as I mentioned, about half of them part-time. The public defense system is the largest user of the court system. We provide services in every county, every courtroom in the state. It is really the quality control of the justice system. We have had a number of prosecutors, a number of police chiefs who will tell you and have told us, frankly, that when our folks are there, when they're available, when they're doing their job, it makes their folks better. It makes sure that the cases that maybe shouldn't be in the courtroom don't get there or are moved out quickly. Caseloads and time commitments, you're going to hear a lot about that. You heard a lot about it from Civil Legal Services. Those are controlled by outside factors. The board really has no control over the number of cases that come in. We have no control over the time commitments involved. And again, we'll talk a little bit about that as we go on. On page 4, Mr. Chairman, you have a pie chart there of the number of cases. We are on track this year to be handling about 165,000 to 170,000 cases. Again, as I mentioned, we are the largest user of the court system. When we break that down into our weighted case system, it breaks down just about evenly. And on page 5, you can see the graph there where the workload or the actual time commitments and workload between at least the four major court case categories is roughly about the same. So as we have obviously a significantly number of misdemeanors or significant increase in number of misdemeanors, when you average that out based on the case weights, it is pretty well evenly distributed among those four case types. The public defenders represent somewhere in the neighborhood of 85 to 90% of all of the serious cases, the serious crimes that come through the justice system. That's pretty standard across the country and has been relatively stable in this state and across the country. About 70% of all cases. They represent roughly, depending on what judicial district you're in, somewhere around 60% of all the misdemeanor cases. The one way that this board or the public defenders are different is we cannot refuse cases. Once those cases are assigned, a public defender cannot refuse those. The state Supreme Court in Zubiag v. Mott declared that several years ago. However, our public defenders are also held to the same ethical standards as any private attorney is. So as those caseloads increase, as corners get cut, as there isn't time to visit folks in jail, as there isn't time to maybe read those police reports of those discovery items and some of the things that Bill Ward's going to talk about, there is a real jeopardy of folks being brought up on issues in front of the discipline board. Right now, as I said, we are handling about 165,000 to 170,000 cases. It works out to be about 746 case units per lawyer. And again, a case unit is, as we weight these cases, roughly the equivalent of a misdemeanor. The caseload standard is about 400. Under the proposed governor's recommendation, that number would increase to about 850 case units. I caution folks as we use these, and they're important, but there is a significant underreporting of cases. And if you can imagine that you're a public defender handling these cases and being swamped the way you are and talking a little bit about the part-timers especially, your top priority isn't probably to fill out your case opening form. Top priorities, obviously, in the courtroom, and again, sometimes having to be in two different courtrooms at the same time. So a lot of times what we're finding, I think, is that folks just don't have the time or aren't reporting those. The other thing the case units tend not to do is to report and reflect time commitments in resolving these cases. And so it is a measure, and we do use it. But we are also cognizant of some of the other issues that are involved as opposed to just surely time commitments. And I want to give you a couple of examples. Our Thief River Falls office. We have an office in Thief River Falls that serves everything north of there to the Canadian border, west of there to North Dakota. The reason we have a Thief River Falls office is we could not find enough part-time public defenders in that area of the state to do this work. They spend about 10% of their time on the road. They cover, all the way to Roseau. They cover all the way to the North Dakota border. Our Mankato office services three different counties out of that office, again, because we just limited staff. We just lost a part-time defender in International Falls. He took early retirement. We have one other part-time defender in International Falls. So we run the lawyer from Grand Rapids to International Falls, roughly 80 or 85 miles one way. We're going to talk a little bit at some point with this committee, and I think the Chief Justice will, about ITV and some of those uses. And I think there's a place for that, but obviously if your client's being held in International Falls, you have some real obstacles in terms of getting there to see that person in person that maybe ITV isn't going to solve. Talked a little bit about part-timers, and again, on some of these cases, on the next page, I believe it's page 8. Last year, our part-timers put in about 44,000 hours that they were not paid for, over and above with what they would basically have contracted for. Again, that's about half of our staff that's doing that. That's roughly the equivalent of 24 full-time equivalent lawyers. Again, you can see the stress that comes on a system where folks aren't being paid for 44,000 hours. Do they do it? Yes, they do it. They do it because they're committed to doing it. They like their work. But it gets to the point where if you're trying to maintain a private practice, how do you maintain that private practice when you're putting in those kind of additional hours? We don't have similar numbers for our full-time staff only because we limit their comp time to 40 hours. And so, they have no incentive or reason to put in anything other than their 40 hours a week, although we know that they're putting in many, many, many more hours than that. Again, it's efficient it's efficient for you all. Obviously, it's efficient for us because they cover their own overhead. But the question becomes is how long can you rely on folks to continue to do that? Those 44,000 hours are up from the previous year, which is about 40,000, and is up from the year before that, which was about 36,000 hours. As I mentioned, Mr. Chairman, the caseloads and the time commitments are not controlled by the board. And those are really controlled, particularly the time commitments, by outside factors. And I want to talk a little bit about some of those outside factors, because not all of them are bad. In fact, some of them are very good. Some of them you all participated in. But again, as Jerry Lane mentioned, we are part of a system, and when we do things over here, it does tend to impact some of the other players in the justice system. And again, we're not criticizing, we're not saying that they shouldn't have been done, but it has kind of added to some of the burden, if you will, of how the system operates. And those are listed out on page 10, but just to highlight a few of them. Between 1987 and 2005, the legislature created 86 sentencing enhancements. Statewide, prosecutors outnumber public defenders basically 2-1. And that's not county attorneys and city. Those are only the folks that are doing the criminal side. Again, I'm not here to tell you that there are too many prosecutors. Just as if you look down, you all created 26 new judgeships over the last 10 years as well. I'm not here to tell you that the court didn't need those 26 judgeships. But no matter what happens in terms of the budget for our office, no matter what happens in terms of the budget for the judiciary, those judgeships are still going to be there, unless, of course, you approve the chair's judge plan, Senate File 200. The prosecutors are still going to be there. The police officers are still going to be there. So it gives you an idea of kind of the system that we're dealing with. 33 drug courts are operating around the state. We all agree that they are having a wonderful impact for those folks who are able to go through those. But again, very labor-intensive. Takes a public defender, takes a prosecutor, takes a judge out of the regular rotation for a whole day to deal with a very small group of people as opposed to being in the regular rotation. Hennepin County recently got a $500,000 federal grant to do DNA testing to help reduce the backload of thousands of cold cases. Again, it's a great thing for the county. It's a great thing for the sheriff's office. But those thousands of cases are now going to be coming into the system that public defenders are going to have to represent. Just a little background going into this year's budget. As you all know, earlier this year, the board had to reduce funding by about 12% of its staff, mostly through voluntary measures. We lost 50 lawyers on our trial level. We lost 3 full-time equivalent lawyers on the appellate level. That's roughly 100,000 hours of attorney time. There were 19 other positions, various positions, that we left unfilled, and I think we probably are pretty close to that still. That was heading into this year. On the appellate level, again, some of the impacts. One of the things that we have found over the years, and it starts on page 12, again, always in the mandated service areas, but one of the things that we have found is as we put more people in prison, those cases tend to go up. Obviously, folks want their appeals heard. We have more folks out on parole, so we do the parole revocation hearings. The end of confinement review hearings for sex offenders, that office provides service in those and in the appeals of those. And if you look on page 13 and 14 of that handout, you can see the increase in the number of cases on the appellate level. And also on page 14, if you look at the number of DOC inmates versus the number of cases opened in parole revocation hearings, you can see how those numbers track almost identically. Again, that's the kind of pressure that system is under. Relative to the governor's recommendation, Mr. Chairman, he is recommending a 5% budget reduction for the board. That is going to equate roughly to 50 full-time equivalent attorneys around the state again. Again, as you heard from Mr. Lane, and I think you heard from the courts, or will hear from them. It's 5%, again, on top of the personnel costs that we will have to absorb from this year into the next biennium, as well as mandated costs of insurance and also pension. If we lose another 50% of our 50 lawyers, I should say, that's enough, again, about 14% of the staff, about 100,000 hours of attorney time. There is no guarantee we're going to be able to handle any out-of-custody cases. There will be major delays, if not indefinite delays. We will have to establish some kind of case and time limits for lawyers so they have some kind of ability to do their work outside of the courtroom, particularly for the part-timers. In greater Minnesota, there will be counties without public defenders. There just will be. There will be no other choice that we will have. And in the metro area, the more metro area, there will be calendars that will go unstaffed. And that's starting to happen right now. And, Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I would like to have Bill Ward just comment on some of these things because, again, he's on the ground. He's seeing some of these things in the 10th District, which is really kind of a microcosm of the state, if you will, with the urban and rural nature.
But cut back to the level there, what how does that go at this point as far as what the number of lawyers are doing on the public defense side?
Well, Mr. Chairman and members, as I said, the top priority will be in-custody clients and dealing with the in-custody clients.
But otherwise, they absent your services, the court would be obligated to dismiss those charges?
Mr. Chairman, I guess, you know, I'll turn that one over to Mr. Ward. They will either be obligated to dismiss them or they will be obligated to basically delay them indefinitely. And, you know.
But you got the timeline.
So. Right. And again, for the in-custody clients, hopefully we're going to be able to maintain service to those, although I'm not sure there's any guarantee of that. Out of custody, they will just go on. And, you know, as Judge Porter mentioned to me the other day, he said there will be a pile of files, and every 2 weeks or so somebody will pick them up and move them to somewhere else. But that's about all that's going to happen with them. So, and I think, again, Mr. Ward can tell you some of the things that have been going on in not only in the 10th District but maybe around the state already as a result of some of the reductions we've had to put in place. So,
Mr. Chair, members, again, I'm Bill Ward, Chief of the 10th District. I want to talk to you a little bit about my perspective, too. I came here 8 years ago from a state that has a county-based public defense system to this state, which is a state-based system. And I came here because of what other jurisdictions were saying about us, about its consistency of public defense, about how efficient we were and how we applied our services, and the training that we provided to our lawyers. And when I got here in 2001, it truly was that system. I mean, we were that system that we should all be proud of. I'm telling you, we should all be embarrassed about what's happened to us over the past 8 years. And it's not just because I'm biased about it. I mean, I'm watching it. I'm a citizen, and I'm seeing what's happened. And I'm embarrassed to be telling you as a chief what I'm watching happening in my own district. Now, the 10th District is the second largest district of public defense in our state, just behind Hennepin County. It's 8 counties. All right, we've got Washington County, Anoka, Wright, Sherburn, Isanti, Kanabic, Chisago, and Pine. So the metropolitan issues are all there, as well as, you know, the urban stuff, as well as the rural issues, which is kind of a microcosm of what's going on and what is the rest of our state. Now, when we got cut, and we've been getting cut over the last couple of years, what happened to my district because of, as Senator Foley, Mr. Chair, you know, in Anoka County, how many CHIPs and TPRs are filed, we were out of proportion compared to the other districts. So my district got cut 19% of its attorney staff. And as the appointing authority or as the chief, I was responsible and am responsible to make sure that I redistribute the resources, our human resources in the district, to level it out as best as we possibly can to provide the services the best we can. And this is our little flow chart. All right, I talk to the board and I show them what's going on. And this thing is starting to look like the bombing of Dresden. Okay, so it's not just the staffing cuts. It's the shifting of people to deal with these cases. And what happens with that? We have lawyers going from one county to another. We have clients who have never met their lawyer. I was in court in Cambridge, and it was embarrassing for clients to come in. There was difficulty communicating, obviously. Never talk to their lawyer because they have no phone. The case is set for trial, and here we are. We're supposed to be prepared on these cases in which we're saying, I've never seen the guy before. I've never seen her before. That's what we're doing to our folks. I mean, that's what's happening in the state of Minnesota. When I lost 19% of my staff, the attorney staff, we lost a very, very conservative estimate of 21,500 attorney hours just for the year. So the system itself, the courts, the probation officers, the prosecutors, they're missing 21,500 hours of our time to handle these cases that will never, ever be made up. So we're trying to do the best we can because we're still getting the cases, we still have the clients, but now we're being double, triple, and quadruple booked throughout not just a county, but the other counties within the district. When I lost lawyers and I had to shift lawyers, places like Wright County went from 4 lawyers to handle conflict cases to 1 3-quarter time equivalent to handle conflict cases. So now I'm responsible, and the manager's responsible, to make sure that we have people traveling from other counties just to handle the conflict cases. That's true in Wright, Sherburne, Kennebec, Chisago, Pine, everywhere. And people driving all over the place. When Kevin says that we have 2-to-1, prosecutors to public defenders, again, I get that, okay? The county boards recognize what's needed to do their cases. I recognize they do civil cases as well. But the reality is not just 2-to-1 lawyers. The prosecution, our adversaries, the people who are there to charge these crimes, have the state troopers, have the sheriffs, have the local police officers, have victim witness programs, have corrections. They've got all this group of people versus our folks. Why is that important? I'm responsible for the cases in the 10th District. On average, between 23,000 and 25,000 cases a year, I'm responsible for them. I have the equivalent of less than 50 lawyers. I have 2 paralegals for 25,000 cases a year. I have 4 investigators for 25,000 cases a year. I mean, that's amazingly crazy, okay? To put it in perspective, in places like Anoka County, where they charge out well over 1,000 cases a year, they've made the charges, they've done the investigation, and the case gets into the court system, a case is filed. Of those cases, anywhere from 5 to 10% of those felony cases are dismissed a year. Dismissed. Doesn't go forward. And the vast majority of the reasons those cases are dismissed because our office gets involved with them. We do investigations, we talk to the witnesses, and we're involved in those cases. Now imagine what's happening if we're not getting involved earlier in the process. Imagine how these folks' lives are affected. People who didn't commit the crimes, or they certainly couldn't prove it, because they're outwardly dismissed from non-felonies. That's true across the district, not just one county. What's happened on anecdotal things like in November, we were trying a case in Washington County. It's a very, very serious, high-profile case. It was a murder case. The prosecutor could take the month off and did take the month off of all of her responsibilities because she was able to prepare for that month in getting this case ready for trial. Our lawyers were working up in other cases in other courtrooms up to the day of trial. What's happened in places like Cambridge and Anoka, Chicago. The attorney yesterday, on Monday, there were, on average, every lawyer in our office had 5 to 8 cases they had to be prepared for trial, for jury trial. 5 to 8 cases. There's not a single lawyer in private practice or a civil lawyer in private practice that's ever had to prepare for more than 1 case that's set for a jury setting. 1. And our folks are expected to be prepared for 5 and 8 every trial calendar. Every one. So you got people who are sitting there who are getting embarrassing poor representation. That's something we should be embarrassed about. That's what we've become. That's what we've done to our folks. We've got, again, we are a wealthy state, right? And I think that we, for the most part, we are a wealthy district. I have the 8 counties. We actually cover 3 calendars for bail hearings out of 8 counties. 3, Anoka, Washington, and Sherburne. And the only reason we're able to have staff at the Anoka and Washington courthouse for bail hearings is because of volunteer law students. I have volunteer law students who are in court talking to people charged with crimes. They're just charged. Again, 10% of them are going to be set free at least. And we have law students doing that work because I don't have the staff to do it. In the other five counties, I got nobody to do it. So imagine, you know, your friends, your family, your neighbors whose kids are being charged, they haven't hired private counsel or they can't. I've got nobody there to represent them at the bail hearing. Embarrass every one of us. I don't care which side of the aisle we're on. We've got a situation now where, again, we've got 80 to 90% of the cases. We should be prepared for these things because an efficient system deals with cases up front and early. Instead, we've lost folks either through layoffs or leave. We are losing well-trained lawyers because they're not sticking around in a system that's not being funded. So I am taking time, energy, and money to train outstanding lawyers just to lose them someplace else because of the fear of not having a job, and most importantly now, because they can't handle the pressure. We're asking for people to give more time. My God, I mean, we're asking for people. We're not just getting time out of them. We're taking their emotional stock away from them because they're just, it's relentless, the amount of cases they're coming in, how many cases be prepared for. I haven't talked to her. I haven't talked to him. Yet we're being forced to be in one court then another court. By the way, I have to go to another county judge because they're calling for me over there. Can I get your help on this, sir? It's not happening. That's the system we should be embarrassed about. Continuity of representation. Wouldn't you like it if you got a lawyer, you saw your lawyer, and you had that same person, so they knew your name. They knew what happened in the last court date. They knew why you were here today. By losing lawyers, by losing the staff that we have, we're bouncing people from lawyer to lawyer just to make do. So I'm walking. I was in court in a couple weeks ago. I couldn't tell what was going on in this case. There's documentation. I couldn't tell the client. I had to have the client tell me what was happening. I'm the chief public defender. I've been doing this for 22 years, and I have a client telling me why it was continued and why it's being set down for today's date. That's what we've done to our folks. That's what we've done to our system. To say that, you know, delays affect cases, I mean, is the most gross misunderstatement we could possibly have. By us not being prepared, people are in jail longer, or they're on probation violations longer, or their cases aren't being prepared for trial or hearing. I mean, that's what's going on. We're costing people money. We're costing jurisdictions money because they can't prosecute the cases as fast, get fines and fees faster, because we're delaying these things longer and longer. In Anoka County alone, our felony cases are not being set for trial for at least 8 months from the initial bail hearing, which they're lucky to have a law student to attend. I mean, 8 months is as fast as we can get to these things. That's why we should be embarrassed about the system. The fact of the matter is that we are still training our people the best we can. We are still trying these cases. And we're doing a darn good job with the resources that we have. We can't do it any longer. I mean, to say it's broken, I mean, there's a huge crack right now, and water's running out of the side. This is with the cuts we already have. I can't imagine what I'm going to do with our staff, assuming I have the staff to do it, with any further cuts proposed by the governor. I mean, to say that we're putting cases out, we can't even how can I accept cases as a lawyer if I'm subject to the same standards as other attorneys? I'm ineffective. I can't investigate the case. I can't talk to the witnesses. Evidence that presumably is there will be lost or forever forgotten about. And yet, that's what we're asking us to do, and that's the best we're going to provide our citizens. The cuts in this system are so ridiculous that in Anoka, we're not given the paper calendar every day because they're trying to save money in a frickin' piece of paper in the courtrooms, but it's going to the clerks, it's going to the sheriffs, it's going to the court reporter. That's how crazy this is. Our cuts are way beyond that. It's affecting people's lives, your constituents' lives, every single day, and it needs to stop.
Just to be clear, what you had requested, and it looks like it's just to maintain what you're doing right now, was about, what, $7 million for 2010 and 11.8 in 2011. Is that's accurate? And then comparing, if I read it through, the governor's proposed cuts of about $3.4 million each year, That translates to a loss of about 150 lawyers plus about 10 appellate counsel? Is that what it translates to?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Betzelt, that was under the 10%. Under this 5%, we're looking at an additional 50 lawyers.
50,
from the, in addition to the 50 that we lost this past June or July. So it'll be we'll be down roughly a quarter or a little bit between 25 and 30% of the staff that we had at the end of last fiscal year. So, Mr. Chairman, just very briefly, and again, I know as Mr. Lane said, it's kind of irrational to be talking about it in the climate that we're in, but Senator Betzel mentioned we are asking for the funding to get the 53 lawyers back that we lost this spring. The 2010-2011 personnel costs, and obviously those have changed dramatically since this was put together. I don't think there's any expectation that anybody's going to be seeing any kind of across-the-board increases or those kinds of things. But as I mentioned, we do have the personnel costs that we've already committed to, you know, this year or in last year that are going to have to be paid in 2010 and 2011. Two other items that are in there. One is our mandated costs, and if you look at the last page of this document, one of the big issues we're going to have to deal with or continue to deal with is transcripts in the appellate office. The budget is roughly $300,000. On average, you know, over the last several years, we're averaging about $675,000. We did not come to you this year with a deficiency request. We're going to try to manage that on our own. The court reporters are not happy about that, but we're going to manage it by doing the best we can to save everything that we can, to pay them whatever we can, and we'll carry forward the deficit into next year. But we're going to try to manage that again, because it just didn't seem prudent to be coming to you all again for funding, given what we know you're going through. The last piece is our public defense corporations. We have four of them around the state that predate the board that provide about 4,500 to 4,700 cases a year, service in those cases, for a minimal amount of money. And again, if those fail, those cases are going to come to us. So,
Mr. Chair, Mr. Kyer, what's a public defense corporation? And then if you ask that, I have another question.
Chairman, Senator Higgins, there are four of them nonprofit corporations. They're basically legal service corporations that provide criminal defense services. The Legal Rights Center in Minneapolis is one. Neighborhood Justice Center in St. Paul. There's the Duluth Indian Legal Services, and then what we've helped to get off the ground, the Regional Native Public Defense Corporation that serves Leech Lake and White Earth. So.
Okay. And then my other question is, Mr. Chair, I think there's a bill that got introduced this year to eliminate transcripts. Do I remember
that? I'm aware of, but I know that issue has arisen before.
I think Senator Moore has a bill to do that, and
yeah.
I was wondering what the public defenders thought of that in light of this chair.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins, there's a couple of different issues relative to transcripts. The one that you're referencing in Senator Moore's bill is the transcript of a video or audio out of a police car, particularly in DWI stops, that use at trial. And those are particularly used a lot in Hennepin County and Ramsey County, but I suspect in a lot of places. And there are some concerns that if those aren't produced as they're required to be produced now, we're going to have to pay for those. So there's a potential there for a cost shift. The other one, the one we're talking about here, is the trial-level transcript that the appellate lawyers have to use in all of these appeals. So it's a different animal, but transcripts. Yeah.
Thank you.
I want you to know that I am the sponsor of the legislation that come from the state alcohol team of Professor Simon. And there's a large number of prosecutors and others that are on this group, and I'm carrying that bill.
Okay. All right. Mr. Chairman, then I misspoke, because it's your bill, and I'm not familiar then with Senator Moore has a different bill on the trans,
yeah. Bill as well, so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the eye-opening testimony.
very embarrassing, at the very least, to a lot of the town. There's no question about it. One of the questions I have is your weighted case standard. Where does that come from? 400 cases versus what you have now.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, that came from a legislatively funded weighted caseload study that was done early 90s. So when we talk about 400, that's the number of case units, which is roughly the equivalent of a misdemeanor, because obviously folks do a mixed bag of cases. But when you weight it all out, that's what that chart shows.
A follow-up question, Mr. Chair. In my former life, some years back, and the way time flies when you're having fun, I know it's been a long time we've been talking about ITV. Can you give me any good answer as to why we haven't moved it further any faster than we have with ITV? And would that save? Would that save you having to travel from? Obviously it will. And is that Supreme Court or appellate court decision driven? Or isn't it about time we start looking at that?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Ingebrigtsen, let me take a stab at it, and then if Bill wants to chime in here. The technology is there. In fact, we have this issue going on right now in Olmsted County is, number one is how it's going to be used. In other words, you can't have the prosecutor and the judge together in one room without the defense attorney. Then the issue is, where are you going to do that ITV from? And I understand the sheriff's desire to have more of this because they have incur a significant cost in transporting in-custody clients back and forth between the courthouses. But if that's the case and all it is merely a shift for our folks now to have to travel, how is that going to work? Also is, particularly in greater Minnesota, you have mixed calendars where you have in-custody clients, out-of-custody clients. So if the public defender, or any defense attorney for that matter, has to go out to the regional jail or has to go out wherever that ITV location is to be there and then has to be back in the courtroom, how is that going to work? So there are some things that are going to have to be worked out in that relative to who's paying for what and how it's actually going to work for scheduling and all those purposes. But I don't know, Bill, if you've got anything else you want to...
Mr. Chair, members, where it's used, and it seems to be used well, Washington County has it, for instance. It's in the jail. It's televised and beamed to families in a courtroom in the courthouse. There's no transfer of bodies from one place to another. But in that situation, the judge, the prosecutor, the probation officer, and the attorney are all in the jail conducting the interview. A lot of places where it's being proposed to save this money, as Mr. Kyer had said, is, you know, ultimately, our office, we have to be with the client. Fairness issue and an issue regarding equality if a lawyer and the client are in one county and the judge and a prosecutor in another county. And that's kind of the kinks I think everybody's trying to work out. It seems to work well as far as in theory. I've been a part of ITV quite a bit, and it's really not as great as the technology is going to be there, but there's a lot of this, you know, when people are talking, and that's been somewhat of the downside.
Mr. Chair, just on the ITV issue, isn't it possible in some cases you might have to have one defense lawyer in the courtroom with the judge and the prosecutor and then another defense lawyer at the remote location, you know, with the accused, and so you now have two lawyers instead of having one?
Exactly. Mr. Chair, members, and that's what we did in Chicago. That's what they do there. But you're literally doubling your staff to do the same call that you're doing with one person before.
Yeah, so I understand this. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a trade-off. It's a security issue, and that's where it's at then.
Yeah.
And so I understand. Thanks.
The issue there, though, comes up in the interpreters and others that could be at a different location, and technology would make connections different. And that sets one standard. Other than just the court time, there's got to be different ways to deal with it.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just a comment. I certainly understand the dilemma we're in here. And the public end of the state wants a crime-free area to live in, or at least a relatively crime-free area, but they have no idea what it costs to do that. And we have to stay on top of this. Because my fear is, I know everybody at the table, I think, that we are going to be letting people go, that they don't get a speedy trial, or gets all messed up in the system because we don't and aren't taking care of our not only statutory obligation, but our...
It's a tougher role here than what a lot of people thought. To figure out how to do that and do it without any money.
That's right.
I have another witness that wishes to speak on this. Alexander DeMarco.
Yes, sir. Chairman, my name is Alexander DeMarco. That's D-E-M-A-R-C-O. First of all, I should stress that I don't come here today representing the Board of Public Defense per se. I am a full-time public defender in the 3rd Judicial District. I'm here to give a little bit of perspective. Some of you may remember me, and some may not, when I worked as a legislative intern here for Senator Steve Murphy in 2000. Since then, I've met a number of you on some DFL campaigns, particularly Ms. Higgins, Senator Betzold. You probably remember me as Steve Novak's campaign manager during his bid for Congress and his, some would say, futile bid to retake his Senate seat afterwards, but needed a young college graduate to do it, and I was able to do it. I come to you today as a friend who, in large part, shares a progressive vision for the state, but also is possessed of a grave responsibility that I and other public defenders bear in our work in the other equal branch of government, the judiciary. In the governor's State of the State address and in his recent budget presentation, he consistently likened the state government to Minnesota families. Right now, Minnesota families are spending evenings at the dinner table, including me, figuring out how to survive these hard economic times. They are tightening their belts, the governor reminds us again and again, and the government should do likewise. They are reassessing their priorities and deciding what spending is necessary, what is non-essential, and government should do likewise, says the governor. I'm not sure what sort of family would purposefully prevent itself from generating adequate revenue during such hard times, but the governor's tax policy is perhaps a separate issue that will doubtlessly be addressed by the legislature at large. The governor also stressed that one of the essential priorities for the state is public safety. Though courts and the public defender are listed as public safety expenditures that this committee helps regulate, according to the legislative website, I fear too often the priority of public safety gets translated into more boots on the ground, i.e., more police officers. There's an idea that if we can just get more police officers on the street to crack down on crime and arrest people, that will address our public safety needs. But any judge, court clerk, prosecutor, public defender, or probation officer can tell you that is literally just the beginning of the process of justly, and we are told swiftly, applying the law to the facts and ensuring that only the guilty are punished and then punished only for what they've actually done. Between arrest and punishment is the high-pressure and high-stress environment of criminal law and justice. This is not just another government program. This is government. The judicial function is as essential as the legislature to the security and freedom of our state. If it is not done with competence and diligence, all the laws you pass here are in vain, for their application to the residents of the state falls short of their intended benefits and consequences. Perhaps tougher criminal laws do benefit safety. As a man with a wife and a baby boy, I welcome such laws if they indeed serve that end. But they are useless if the workhorses that process these cases are not there. This is the height of government power. This is the system whereby the government tells a person, you're not free to live where you want to live. You're going to live in an 8x10 cell for a period of time. If this is not done with diligence, the damage to liberty in the aggregate to all of us is absolutely irreparable. The Office of the Public Defender is an office that is mandated by the Constitution of the United States and by its Supreme Court. It is solely the responsibility of this government. It cannot be outsourced. There are no privately subsidized charter courts, so to speak, that can ease the burden of justice. And no church is going to step up and supply legal counsel for those who have a right to one but cannot afford one. If the government is to be likened then to a family, then you and I are part of it. And if we are hashing out what is necessary and essential government spending and what is luxury, I would submit to you that courts and the Office of the Public Defender are indeed not a luxury at all, but are the very core of what it means to govern. A decision to cut these already lean and struggling institutions also cannot square with any legitimate ideology. It is not progressive to slash legal representation for the indigent in the face of the aggressive machine of criminal prosecution. It does not comport with conservatism, which preaches smaller, more efficient government, to cut funding to a constitutionally mandated organization like the Public Defender, whose operating costs are 95% staff compensation, compensation which by itself is hardly abundant given the cost and debt incurred by a legal education and the comparative opportunities these public servants could have pursued. Were we a private law firm, our productivity would be beyond compare. We do four times the work for a fourth of the pay, representing nearly 90% of all criminal defendants in Minnesota accused of serious crimes. Conservatives speak of government having a limited role, and it could hardly be said that criminal justice does not fall squarely within this role. I'm here today not to grovel and beg for my job. It's not even clear that I myself would be laid off were we to incur the governor's suggested funding cuts. It is clear that several less senior people in our district would certainly be cut, and that my already strained caseload would become absolutely and categorically unmanageable. I have an ethical obligation to represent my clients diligently and backed by sound legal research and knowledge. This will not be possible if more attorneys are laid off. But more directly, I drove all the way from Owatonna today because I believe you and I have something in common, and that is we both have an overwhelming and almost irrational desire to see to it that the right thing happens. Let's face it, neither you nor I took these jobs for the pay. There are a lot easier ways for me to make $50,000 a year than to rack my brain in a law school for 3 years after college and incur six figures of student loan debt that will burden me until I'm 60. There are certainly a number of vocations that you are all qualified for that would pay far more than your Senate positions and take up a lot less of your time and not have the added instability of your livelihood depending on the will of the people every election cycle. Neither of us chose easy jobs. We chose jobs to serve. I came here simply to put in perspective just how indispensable our justice system is and how frail it has become, and to ask you to weigh its function and the consequences of its collapse. I would ask you to weigh carefully the small amount of funds it will take to keep the public defender intact versus the myriad of other things you're being asked to spend money on that are perhaps, at this difficult time, not so soundly at the very heart of government's obligation. As we sit around this table setting our priorities to balance the budget as a government, I am confident that the public defender will emerge as a clearly important expenditure for an essential part of government already doing so much with so little and serving justice in an efficient and competent manner. I thank the committee for its time. Yes, I can have those copies. I already have Mr. Reslin's address or email address. I can email attached copies to him, and he can distribute it to the members. I'll put it in letter form. All right. Thank you. I believe somebody may have left their glasses here.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'm David Paul. I'm the Executive Secretary of the Board on Judicial Standards. Have a little voice problem today. I'm sorry. I'll do my best to make myself heard. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to speak briefly with you here today. The governor has recommended that our small budget go in unchanged. I think that this is recognition of the reasons why it was passed last time. It's only one session old. And some of you may recall that at the time, the last time that the basic appropriation given to the Board on Judicial Standards was had not been raised for over 8 years, and the board was in pretty bad shape. At the point that the new appropriation came in, we had only 3 or 4 months' worth for rent. We were not being able to pay our board members for their expenses, et cetera, et cetera. And this committee and the legislature came through and was just extremely helpful for us. And it's been a great relief to us all that we can get back into doing the things that we were originally set out to do. Also, the legislature was foresighted enough to give us a revolving fund of $125,000. The purpose of that fund to be for attorney's fees and investigation fees, which has been used many times since its appropriation to the board. We were doing the same things before, but probably with less frequency, but we were having to spend so much more per hour and per case on these expenditures because we were deficit spending the whole time. We would have to go to our attorneys and say, we want you to hire this investigator, have them to do it, and then the attorneys would hold the bills and pay them, pay the investigators directly, and then hold the bills to us until we could get enough money to pay them, which we always did. But at this point, it's a lot easier for us, and it's a lot better because we can get the rates cheaper because we can negotiate direct, and also we can pay them right away, which is a significant thing for us. And this has been used several times this year to just great success. The board is acting now on better information than it has ever had since I began. I think it's probably fair to say that it has ever had in its history. So I'm here to answer any questions that you may have or give you any information that you may need.
Members, do you have any questions?
Mr. Chair, just to be clear, the current biennium was $360,000, and then we increased that to $562,000. Is that how it worked? And then the governor just kind of evened it out to $460,000 per biennium. I'm just, you know, the numbers add up the same thing. I'm just trying to figure out just how we got to where we got to.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I think you're correct. Okay. The revolving fund is figured into that also, and it is $125,000 per fiscal year. Okay. So, yeah. Maybe everybody has sympathy over my voice. Well, thank you, Senator Foley, and members.
Thank you.